really delighted to introduce a long-standing friend of the IWA, Carol Green, who is ITV Cymru Wales' Brexit correspondent now. So who better to chair this next chunk of our discussion, which is what is Wales' soft power capital, according to the people in the room? Carol.
Thank you, Ariel, and Prithanda, good afternoon. I'm delighted to chair this session. It's been a really interesting morning, and I hope we can add a little bit more light to that this afternoon. We've got an excellent panel. Get your questions ready. They're prepped and ready to answer those in due course. But I'd just like to start by introducing who we've got. I'll start at the far end here. We have Roger Lewis, Chair of Cardiff Airport. Long-standing and experience in across business, music, sports, and we'll be able to draw on all of that this afternoon. Sophie Howe, the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales. Welcome, Sophie. And Kelly TRI, who is the Artistic Director of the National Theatre of Wales. And Professor, you're the Pro Vice Chair of Swansea University. Ewan Davis, and also Chair of Global Wales. So welcome to you all, and thank you for taking part. Our brief this afternoon is to look at the what. What assets have we got in terms of soft power? So I'd like to invite the panel to just kick us off with what do they think Wales has got in terms of soft power? Where do our strengths lie? So Roger, may I begin with you? Just give us a little flavour of where you think our soft power lies.
Okay, thank you so much. And before I begin, I'd just like to congratulate the IWA and the British Council for this event. And I sincerely hope this is the start of a series of follow-ups, because that opening for myself will fit into what I'm about to suggest. And I will be hopefully talking through my own personal lens today. By the way, I also feel I'm almost like at an evangelical meeting, because we're all true believers. Perhaps it's more like it's a meeting of the AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, or Arts Anonymous. But the problem, dare I say, is how do we get to use the words of the chief executive at the start this morning, how do we amplify the attraction? But what I'd also say, how do we align strategies? And that would be underpinning my, if you like, audit of the assets. Because I feel if we wish to engage people who are not in this room, who do not share our ambition, who do not share our vision, who do not share our evangelical belief in the power of, certainly the world I come from, the arts primarily and sport, we're not going to succeed. So language is important, strategic alignment is important. Quite simply, what is the realpolitik of it all? Just to give you a bit of background, again, it's a very personal lens, this is a Welsh lens. I'm a product of that post-war Welsh consensus of a belief in education. I graduated in 1976 from university, so you can guess my age. I've been working for 42 years, but I was a product of the Glamorgan Education Authority, and I achieved my time at university and all of my education and all of my opportunity through that world. And again, perhaps we might return to that. Now, if we're looking at the assets of Wales that give us the soft power, I feel we've got to use the language that will align and will give resonance and meaning to people we can influence to take this argument forward. So I talk about our soft power assets in Wales in terms of what is the wealth? Because there's going to be three areas: wealth, accounting, and economic. If one's looking at wealth, what one needs the assets that indicate our strength as a nation and how we leverage them. And of course, this is a key asset for Wales, a key asset. I was 9 years the group chief executive of this building and of the Welsh Rugby Union. So I was in charge of, if you like, a machine that delivered the content, and I was in charge of the organization that created the content. So we have this machine here. Now, we might talk about how we manage how we leverage this. Very quickly, because it's a long conversation, how I made sense of this business, which was bust in 2006, as some of you know, was to work with our stakeholders to say, how do we sort out the debt? Because we not only inherited this fantastic building, we inherited the debt as well. It was working with government and local authority on the basis of an economic assessment of the benefit that sporting activity would bring to the city. So, as the First Minister said this morning, the UEFA Champions League, the Olympic Soccer, the Rugby World Cup, we only achieved that through a huge investment in this asset. We got that off government and off Cardiff City Council. That's how we achieved it. So the new pitch, the screens, this refurbishment, a whole heap of stuff was delivered to us, and I said to government that we could deliver Soccer World Cup, we could deliver Rugby World Cup, we could deliver the UEFA Champions League final, and it would give an economic benefit to Wales. So we got assets. So we got this asset. The other asset we've got in Cardiff, of course, is the Wales Millennium Centre. What a fantastic asset that is. Again, driven by that partnership between the people who believe in the content creation and government, who can understand the economic benefit that that brings. For a number of years, I was a trustee of the Wales Millennium Centre in the early days before it was built, and we had a big debate over bringing the ring cycle with Gergiev to Cardiff. And we brought the ring cycle with Gergiev to Cardiff. Because it was the Murinsky, they worked on an agenda which they did the ring in four nights. So you had everything from Rheingold to Siegfried to Valkyrie to Gerda Damrung in four nights. It was fantastic. What it meant, we sold out, we filled all the hotels, all the restaurants were full, and we talked in that language, another great asset there. But when you look around Wales, these cultural physical assets start diminishing somewhat, and I'll end it here because I'm conscious we all need to talk on this. If we go into accounting, we need to account how much we invest in our soft power assets. So how much are we investing in the likes of our physical assets? And it's not just about Cardiff. It needs to be about Swansea. It needs to be about Aberystwyth. It needs to be about Caernarfon. It needs to be about Wrexham. What are we doing with that, with those assets to generate income? So we've got a number of assets there, but not that many. And I'm going to come on to perception versus reality perhaps a bit later on. And then you need to look at the economic assets that we've got, if you like, the factors of production. And this is where I'm going to end on and draw breath at the moment, but I can return to all of these points, is what are we doing with the factors of production that are not immediately themselves involved in the process? Which goes back to my personal experience. I came from a small mining village called Kevin Cribble. My father was a shift-working crane driver who left school at 14, who was barely literate. But I went to a school, a state school, a comprehensive school in 1966. It was going up in the world. Previously, it had been a secondary modern school. So we were going places. But we had the full panoply in that post-war consensus of education, where Latin, Greek, additional maths, music, French, German, Spanish was all available to 1,200 pupils in 1966. Now, our factors of production have been hugely eroded and diminished over the past 40 years. We've got to face this, perception versus reality. This is not a left-right conversation. This is not a Labour Conservative argument. This is not a UK Welsh government argument. Basically, from my world of music, because I then went on to study music at university, I was fully funded with a grant. I went to the Royal College of Music as an additional grant from the Glamorgan Education Authority, and I spent all of my career in music, and here I am as the chairman of Cardiff Airport, having done a music degree. Now, we've lost sight of that. We do not invest in education in these so-called soft subjects. We don't. We've got to be real. We're not investing in the area that I care about, the arts. We don't invest in it. And dare I say, we're not investing in sport either. We've got to be real about this. So what we've got to do as passionate believers in this is come up with the arguments that align the strategies that can show the benefit. And dare I say, we mustn't be just a tool of some sort of sociopolicy as well. We've got to figure out how you get the arts to work for the arts that have an economic benefit as well, so that it's art for art's sake. I'll draw breath there. Thank you.
Diolch, Roger. Thank you, Roger. Striking chords there with the room. Sophie, move on to you. We're looking at the what. What are our assets? Where do you think they lie in soft power in Wales?
So I guess as someone who spent the last 2 years in my current role talking about this, you know, the softer things in life, this concept of well-being, the well-being of future generations through our legislation there. Actually, what we're talking about here in terms of soft power is kind of music to my ears. And I guess the concept that we have here in Wales does really recognise the need for us to move beyond the kind of narrow measures of progress that perhaps have kind of we've been obsessed with and have kind of permeated our society for for many years. And for me, the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act is a perfect example of what we're talking about here. And so for our international colleagues in the audience who may not have heard about the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, just a kind of quick overview. So we are the first country in the world to have legislation which puts on a statutory footing a requirement on all our policymakers here in Wales to take decisions which meet today's needs without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. We define sustainable development as improving the social, economic, environmental and cultural well-being of Wales. That's another reason why this legislation is so pioneering. If you look in other parts of the world, you'll see social, economic, environmental well-being within this concept of sustainability, but cultural well-being is often left out. So again, I think that comes back to these kind of softer things in life. And then we've also legislated for this vision of a Wales that we want to see. So the whole of Wales and all of our policymakers and the people who deliver our services are working towards a vision through seven interconnected wellbeing goals. And I think that, you know, in terms of what the report that's being launched today outlines, what we've seen is that Wales is really excelling in terms of the international recognition that it's gaining through sustainable development and sustainability. But I think that you know, our pioneering legislation should put us on the world map, not just in terms of the policies that it's intended to drive and shift. So the fact that we have amongst the best recycling rates in the world, the fact that we were the first in the UK to have the carrier bag charge, the fact that we are the only nation in the UK who's part of some of the groupings around cities and regions for sustainable development, the fact that we have this focus on a shift to a low carbon economy. But actually, those are the specifics, but actually the fact that we have this governance structure around the well-being of future generations and around this concept of well-being really does put us in a position of, I think, being one of the most progressive examples of governance arrangements to recognise these softer issues and indeed the kind of often and long called for but little actually done concept of planning for the long term as well, which is one of those key concepts within the legislation. And so we have these internationally groundbreaking governance arrangements, and we must recognise the power of that in Wales being able to say we have a government here in Wales who is prepared not just to say warm words about the needs to plan for the future and about thinking about well-being and sustainability in its widest sense, but is actually prepared to legislate for that. So within our legislation, as I said, there's this concept of improving the social, economic, environmental and cultural well-being in life. And I think that the recognition that a focus on well-being, so the softer things in life, is important, not just for the human condition, but actually it's important in terms of driving some of those harder measures too. So increasingly livability factors such as access to public open space, artistic and cultural offerings, connectivity of public transport systems are increasingly becoming the things that actually make towns, cities, countries attractive in terms of investment, as well as perhaps what have been the more traditional and harder measures around things like skills. And I think that we can look to cities and states in other parts of the world who are really recognising that as well. And back last autumn, I was fortunate to spend some time in the United States. You don't always think of it as the beacon of sustainability, do you? But actually, the fact that their states have this sort of, you know, have this independence, their governance structure, there are some absolutely brilliant shining examples of things that they are doing on sustainability. And I spent some time in Pittsburgh, which I was particularly interested in because of its parallels in terms of its history to the South Wales Valley. So, you know, a former mining town in the sort of the Rust Belt of the US, who has completely transformed its fortunes from the point in the kind of 1980s where their economy was actually, you know, completely decimated. And how have they transformed their fortunes to become a hub of technology and so on? Well, yes, there was a big focus in terms of the partnership and engagement with their further and higher education institutions. So a three-way partnership between the state government, the local government, and Carnegie Mellon University and Pittsburgh University. But alongside that, and you know, they built on the skills they had there and the expertise that they had in terms of robotics. But alongside that, what they absolutely recognised is just focusing on those skills, which were kind of quite niche skills, then wasn't enough. They actually needed to clean and green the city. They needed to focus on a cultural offering. They needed to focus on the things that were going to make this former industrial black-covered town or city livable. And they're reaping the benefits of that. Likewise, if you look at cities like Odense in Denmark, who are beginning to be described as one of the most livable cities in the world, so they're investing in culture. They have 350 miles of bike lanes. They have more than 120 parks, 250 playgrounds. And the mayor in Odense says that investors are coming because they know people want to live in Odense. Those are the kind of softer measures. They're not necessarily coming because they've chucked all of their eggs in a skills basket. They're coming because of these softer things in life. And so I think that, you know, what our act does recognises that these aspects of our life, so equality, good jobs, clean energy, safe communities, the Welsh language and our unique culture, are all of those things which which Robert Kennedy described back in the 1960s as the things that make life worthwhile. And it's those softer things that we should be focusing on, and increasingly those progressive cities and states are actually focusing on those things rather than hard measures. And perhaps some of the best examples of where we've seen cities and states take this sort of action and come together and show the force that they can be in terms of these soft powers is probably around the Paris Accord back a couple of years ago. And we can see there the power that these kind of, you know, this soft power that is exercised, and the fact that I think here in Wales we have a really good platform to be focusing on that too.
Brilliant. Thank you, Sophie. We'll come back to, I want to come back to some of that afterwards, particularly the leading by example. So we've already got, you know, Roger, sport, music, leading by example in terms of future generations, sustainability. Cully, what do you think Wales has in terms of soft power? What are our assets?
I was quite taken by the comment in the report that says attraction and persuasion is at the heart of soft power, because I think certainly from my discipline in terms of the arts, performing arts, actually that's what we do on a daily basis, is persuade, attract, entice. And if we look back to the notion of culture as it was defined a long time ago, it was about the cultivation of the soul and the mind. It's become much more these days articulated about who are we, what are our values and what are our beliefs, and how do we use those sort of tools of creativity and the arts in general to be able to articulate those things. And I think we have a strong, solid bedrock of that in Wales. There's lots and lots of examples of where that's been possible, and where we've really landed those things because we've worked collaboratively and we've worked sometimes at scale in order to really push that. And I think sometimes our frustration in the cultural sector is that we don't sing about that and shout about that and be bolshy, as Corwin said this morning, about both our ambition and our ability. And so, you know, maybe we need to talk about that in the same way that we talk about the Rugby World Cup, you know. And we know that we can do those things because, you know, our work on City of the Unexpected with all of those thousands of people that came into the city surpassed what the World Rugby did. And actually we had headline front pages in Sydney and in Dubai, and Wales became this sort of extraordinary place where a giant peach had landed in the middle of Wood Street, you know. So I think there's ways in which we want to be able to tell our story, and we have the ability to do that. We sometimes don't do it enough. I suppose when I was thinking about that phrase, attraction and persuasion, I really think that's about the art of conversation. And in any performance activity, I suppose what we're doing is telling stories. And in the root, in that heart of those stories, we're trying to have a conversation, a dialogue with our audience. And that is such a strong and important part of what this conversation is about how do we present ourselves in the world and how does the world get presented to us. And I was really taken earlier in the earlier panel about narrative and about story, but there's lots of complexity around that. Because who is it that is creating our stories? Who is telling those stories? How are those stories being placed and where are they being placed? Those things really matter, and actually we need to be a bit more rigorous in our debate about what that means. So what is the Welsh story? You know, it's a very complex, rich history, but what's its contemporary voice? How is it uniquely different? And I think the arts are a massive tool to exploit that in extraordinary ways. So, you know, Hinterland is an international success. You know, our, you know, I'm Not a Witch, you know, all of that film, Cymru, all of that work that projects both the landscape, the people, the stories is really valuable tools for us. I mean, I think we have an urgent need to want to tell stories as human beings. You know, that is how we leave our mark. That's how we know who we are and what we stand for. And the arts play a really important role in being able to do that. It's not always very easy, and it's sometimes easy to talk about the big flagship institutions because you can point to a building. But actually, some of the most important tools are those where we embed ourselves in communities and work internationally and in partnership. That's where there is a transfer and an exchange of knowledge and experience, because ultimately, soft power is how you made me feel. How did you make me feel? Yeah. And what is it that you have left me with? And what have I shared with you that has touched my life, and what has my life, how has my life been reflected by what you've given me? So I think those are really fundamental planks that we need to really embrace when we talk about soft power. And actually, power is a really interesting word. I know earlier somebody was, Rebecca was saying, she, you know, soft power feels uncomfortable for her. But I think we sometimes need to think about what power is and how are we influencing and shaping that in any given room. You know, who's missing? Who has the loudest voice? How are we playing that? And I think if we're clever, then actually Wales can be very active in that, in our relationship with England, in our relationship with Europe, in our history of our internationalism, our socialism, our politic, and I think perhaps we underestimate the force that that can be. Yeah, I've just come out of rehearsals of a project that's a collaboration between South Asian women from here and in India, and the experience of that was really about us trying to look at it was part of the UK, part of the Wales India year of culture, and part of that was of course recognizing, you know, what that, you know, 70 years of partition, but part of it was also about thinking about, well, where are we now? What does it mean to be here now as a South Asian woman? And actually, how does that experience live with people who didn't come to the UK post-partition or in the 60s when we were invited to do so? How does that dialogue and conversation assist in what we're doing? And actually, we learned as much from each other and that exchange, and our audiences learned stuff about communities that live here that they don't have insight to, and that's through story and through sharing and through performance, and I think those things are really important. I'm really conscious of time, so I can say plenty more, I'm sure, but the one thing I wanted to finish with was years ago, we were doing a writing workshop in a rundown youth club in Skegness. For those of you who don't know where Skegness is, it's a seaside resort on the east coast of England, and, you know, very a long time ago, it was a thriving seaside town. We were doing this writing workshop, and this young woman ended up writing this quote, which has really, really stayed with me, and she said, we all play a different tune on the same violin. And I think there is something about the nature of engagement that's international that is playing to that tune, recognizing that we all want to play a different tune, but part of our reality is that we need to hear it and understand it and connect with it.
Thank you, Kelly. We'll be coming back to those ideas of who are we and our idea of Wales in the discussion later. But Ewan, just what have we got in terms of soft power assets in Wales, in your view, from an education perspective?
Unequivocally, talent, and the role that education has in promoting that talent. Roger's talked about the transformative effect of education. And education, of course, is about the past, it's about the present, and it's about the future. I want to make a really bold statement, which is that universities represent the most successful experiment in global institution making ever. And that Welsh universities have a really important role to play in that regard. All of our universities in Wales, have charter status or corporation status, but the real credibility currency now of any university and any Welsh university is, do we have a world charter? And it's the world charter that really matters in terms of how we project our soft power. So can I talk a little about the past? There's been reference to the Windrush. I can tell you from my institution's perspective, 25% of our chemistry department in the 1930s were from the West Indies. I can say that a number of our alumni hold very senior positions in the context of political positions. A number, this summer in Swansea, for example, we are going to be providing an honorary fellowship to a past Indian defense minister. A number of senior people in universities worldwide, the so-called class of 2030, the class that looks like the new class of progressive universities, are graduates from Welsh universities. Now that's people in the ground making huge differences in creative economies. At the same time, when you're looking at ways in which that soft power works, you can think about ways in which, for example, this morning, Chinese Football Association were in Swansea talking to the ways in which we were providing coaching expertise for 60 coaches coming from China who make a huge impact around China in terms of our influence as Wales and Welsh University to a forthcoming generation. And it's how universities bridge the arts, how they bridge legislation, creative legislation, and also, of course, the way in which we bridge sport. It's bringing together the Welsh asset in a very, very special way. I can give you another example how Welsh universities can actually make a difference. Offset arrangements, even practical economic issues, when developing countries require offset requirements, where can that offset be spent? It can be spent on education. So that's an example to you of how there's a reach out of particular universities in a way which can actually make an economic difference. But fundamentally for us, of course, we have 22,000 international students in Wales today. And those 22,000 bring a social, economic, and cultural aspect to how we operate. And those 22,000 students also have parents, also have friends. And what I can say to you is that by far the majority of the international tourist spend in Wales is higher education related. 3.7% of our exports relate in tourism come from that source. So this is a phenomenon. It's one where we must excel. There are 20,000 universities in the world, and each of those universities have a place in the world. And of course, what we must seek to do is promote our authenticity, promote our scholarship, and of course, deal in an authentic way with research challenges, because it's research which gives us credibility, and it's research which actually relates to the big challenges in the world are global. And those are our assets. We must ensure that we project those properly and in a responsible way.
Thank you. And interesting you mentioned research there. Of course, in the report, we saw that we were not doing so well on the R&D front, that really is a challenge for us. And we've started on a positive note, but it's my job also to tease out those areas where, you know, there is a gap where we're not doing quite so well. So I'd like to hear the panel's view on that. Where are the challenges, starting with you, Roger? That is there a gap between the reality and the perception of what we've got?
I think there's a considerable gap between perception and reality in Wales. I think we culturally kid ourselves, and I think a lot of political lip service is given to Wales. I'll give you a couple of headlines. One is audit. To carry on this business language, I really feel we need to audit what we do in Wales. And we can start at it from a very positive point of view. 3 miles up the road is Whitchurch School. That school produced two incredible people, Gareth Bale and Sam Warburton. Sam is 29 years of age. Gareth is exactly the same age. Gareth plays for Real Madrid. Sam is the captain of the British and Irish Lions and captain of Wales. Now, let's start auditing that stuff. What are the pathways to deliver those two incredible people, which are true ambassadors of our soft power around the world? And by the way, Gareth Bale is most probably one of the most famous Britons across the world. You know, because let me just talk about rugby, because I took Wales to 3 Rugby World Cups in my tenure of office. We mustn't kid ourselves about rugby. So let me pick with the ball that you've thrown me here. Rugby is only played professionally by 10 countries in the world. Mm. Of those 10, only 9 have got professional rugby teams. So we've got to be really tough on ourselves with this. So when you get this fantastic spike of Rugby World Cup, okay, but let's really audit and understand what is the incremental soft power benefit to Wales, and how do we leverage that? Rugby is so important for ourselves in Wales in terms of our self-identity, our self-expression, our place within the world, the small world in which we live. But on a global perspective, we've got to get real. Cardiff City, unfortunately, as you know, they didn't have a good game the night before last, but if Cardiff City get up into the Premiership, that is so important for our perception around the world. The number of people who watch Premiership soccer in China and in the Gulf is off the scale. So what are we doing to support that sort of activity? To be fair to Cardiff City Council, they were brilliant at what they did with the stadium. They were brilliant at what they did with Leckworth. Fantastic. But what are the other jewels in the crown? The Welsh National Opera is this incredible jewel we've got here in Wales. Do we talk about it to ourselves? Do the BBC regularly talk about it? The BBC has got its own symphony orchestra. How many times is that symphony orchestra talked about on Good Morning Wales? Seriously, it should be on Good Morning Wales every time it has a concert, and it does 50 or 60 concerts, but we don't do it. We don't talk about that. Now, perception reality. We talk about music. We are the land of song. Now, you audit how many people sat GCSE music in Wales last year. Goodness me, you track that back. You track how many Welsh musicians are in the BBC National Orchestra of Wales now. How many Welsh musicians sit in the desks of the London orchestras? I came up alongside, I was in the National Youth Orchestra of Wales, and all of those senior desk players went on to top positions in UK orchestras. The school I went to, the guy sitting next to me went off to Cambridge to read music. About 5 others went off to conservatoires to study music. What's going on now? The pathways have gone. Are we the land of song? Oh, thank God we've got people like Bryn Taffel. Bryn is one of the most brilliant ambassadors around the world because he wears Wales literally. The heart is not just on the sleeve, it's across the whole body. I was the worldwide president of Decca Record Company. I was president in Salzburg when Bryn premiered in Richard Strauss's Salome at the Salzburg Festival. He sang Johannan in the early 90s. Snowdon towered over the Alps that day, and Bryn made sure everyone in the reception afterwards made sure that everyone knew he was from Wales and how important Wales was for him. Now, we need to identify more of those Bryn Terfels. We need to identify more of those Gareth Bales. But we need to understand, this is the audit, how do we produce those? Bryn went to the Guildhall School of Music. Bryn's name is, if you go into the Guildhall School of Music, you'll see he was one of the medal winners as a young student. He came through the Irth. There is BBC footage of Bryn singing at an Irth festival. So what are we doing with these pathways? The Irth, the Eisteddfod, school, GCSE music, A-level music. The number of people who sat A-level music in Wales last year, it's embarrassing. What do we do in the National Youth Orchestra of Wales? Do you know now, I went full grant on the National Youth Orchestra of Wales. Do you know how much it costs to go on the National Youth Orchestra of Wales now? You've got to pay £500. Now, my family couldn't have paid £500 to go on the National Youth Orchestra of Wales. And the Glamorgan Youth Orchestra, all these other youth orchestras which have disappeared, that's the reality. Are we the land of song? Thank goodness, within our DNA, within that vein, there is cultures. Only Men Allowed is one of the positives, where it reinvigorated young men singing music, young men singing in choirs, because we know male voice choirs are the pursuit of people of my age and older. So we need to identify these triggers, these Pied Pipers, that we can, and we need to support them. But this audit and this reality check of where we are in Wales needs to be backed up by using the words of audit, using the words then of economic benefit, social benefit as well, because we know when we go into communities, as some have, that this works so well. And then identifying people who are prepared to go in. Just one thing before I end. Owen Shears, I know Owen was going to be here today, but he's not. Owen Shears, one of our greatest playwrights, and has worked with brilliant work with the National Theatre of Wales. Owen is such a smart guy, because not only has he written such great literature, The Dust Diaries, if you've not read it, you must read it. It is a lyrical, poetic novel of following his family roots in South Africa. But Owen had this personal passion for matters military. And if you've read his extended poem on Pink Mist, following the story of three young soldiers from Catterick, it is quite extraordinary. But then what he did with Charlie F, working with disabled men and women injured in the Afghan war, all of a sudden, you're taking the arts with his artistic voice into an area which then engages, and this is the bit I'll end, opinion formers and most importantly decision makers who are going to be so important to help us in what we believe in to create the assets that deliver soft power. Because the reality is, unfortunately, our political leaders in the main, on all parties, in both London and here in Cardiff, have no, unfortunately, personal interest and passion in the arts. You go to the Millennium Centre and see Welsh National Opera, and you look around, you'll see Lord Davidel, thank goodness. You'll see a few others, but you won't see that. We'll not see them. Angela Hewitt did the Bach Goldberg Variations. It was incredible, 2 weeks ago. I don't know if anyone went to that at St. David's Hall. Amazing, 80 minutes of the most cerebral Bach. You look around the audience and you think, I'm amongst friends, because I see them time and again in the concerts of an age, of my age, and I'm thinking, goodness me, but we haven't got the political decision makers and the opinion formers there, so we need to get to them, we need to use their language, we need to audit, we need to leverage. And by the way, the First Minister, his last words were, get back in touch and use me. Well, we've got to be all over him. And that's why today we start the journey and we've got to leverage this. And he's going to stay on in the Assembly as an Assembly member until the next election. So could this be part of his legacy? He said it today.
Food for thought there. Thank you, Roger. The idea then of evidence and where are those pathways? You know, have they been eroded? Who are our ambassadors? Where does that soft power lie to project Wales around the world? Sophie, some of the challenges. Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps I'll build on some of the things that Roger said. Roger, you talked about audit. I'm actually going to build on that by talking about the things that we measure, because I think we measure the wrong things. We have very narrow measures of prosperity and narrow measures of well-being, and that in the way that we do that prevents us from getting to some of the things that you're talking about. When we think about, and I'm a proud Whitchurch High School girl myself. But when we think about some of those softer things that happened in that school to produce your Gareth Bales and your Sam Warburtons, none of that, I reckon, would ever be picked up in terms of, you know, an audit and inspection type regime that we have at the moment. Because the things that would probably have made a difference there are individual teachers, their passion, their relationships with their students. It's those softer things that we find really difficult to measure. And we can see this right across the way we do all of our public policy. And there's a big challenge here for politicians. I'm not sure we've got any politicians remaining in the audience now, but this kind of craving of politicians, you know, give me the hard measures, tell me about the ambulance waiting times and the A&E waiting times, and tell me about the increase in GVA. And actually, those are not necessarily the things that actually make a difference to the lives that we lead. So I think that we are measuring the wrong things, and in measuring the wrong things, we're doing, it's encouraged us to continue to do the wrong things. So if we think about this concept of kind of the health and well-being of our nation, the fact that only 15% actually of the health and well-being of our nation is dependent on healthcare services, so the NHS and the likes, and yet 49% of the Welsh Government budget is invested in healthcare services. We need to be having some really brave discussions and taking some brave decisions about how we start to shift that to these things that make life worthwhile. And those things, the other 85%, are the sorts of things that we're talking about today. It's whether you live in decent housing, it's whether you are able to participate in sport and physical activity, it's whether you feel kind of good about the place that you live. And I think, you know, that can go from a very local level, whereby whether you live in a kind of concrete jungle or whether you live near to, you know, to open space, whether the high street that you're living, you know, your local high street has been absolutely decimated, or whether there's a little influx of new coffee shops and things that sort of make those areas interesting, right up to things like the passion that the whole nation feels on a Rugby International Day here in Cardiff. And I, you know, thinking about what Cully said about, you know, how we make people feel, it made me think about that Mayor Angelou quote, which was, people will forget what you said, they'll forget what you did, but they'll never forget the way that you made them feel. And I think our public policy making focuses too much on the said and the did and the hard measures, and doesn't get us close enough to that stuff, which is the stuff that makes us human, as I said, the stuff that makes life worthwhile, the stuff which is, you know, which makes us feel good.
Thank you. And also that's what we bring back, isn't it, when we travel. It is what we, you know, it's what we feel, or that's what you remember, and that's the story that you pass on. Yeah. So, Cully, as a storyteller, pick up the threads.
Pick up the story. Well, I'd like to say a couple of things. One is that, you know, in a way, we've made some grand statements, and that's fantastic, about creative learning and in embedding culture in everything that we do. But actually, we need to do some hard work around what does that actually mean and how serious are we? Because if we're really serious, it's a bold, extraordinary thing to want to achieve, but it means some action rather than rhetoric. And I think that's really important. That, and also it requires us all to work collectively together, because there are some hard choices, but these are not binary choices. You know, lots of cute things cumulatively impact on each other. And actually, you know, Wales as much as UK broadly, we've got into a mindset of short-term solutions rather than long-term goals that we collectively need to work to. And I think that's an important part of the conversation we need to have. I think the second thing I would like to talk about, or at least raise, is the notion of risk. You know, how, in order to be bold and radical and revolutionary, we need to jump in sometimes with both feet without necessarily knowing exactly what the outcome might be, or what the tangible economic benefits might be, or justify to me that this is going to work. Well, sometimes you can't, you know, and actually as a nation we need to be bold about that and go, we're going for it, you know. There are hundreds of examples of where people have taken a deep breath and done something. You know, the most, you know, even most recent stuff like Hull with the City of Culture, or, you know, Our House, all of those things are about people being bold enough to go, we're going to go for it. And sometimes you might get a knockback, but that shouldn't mean that you give up. It means you get up, you brush yourself down, you learn, and you move on. And I think I would advocate that we need to be more risk ready and more risk supportive. And it's not about being banal about it. You know, we don't, you know, we recognize that we're all managing risk all of the time. You know, no show we ever make, whether it's Welsh National Opera or National Theatre Wales, is bereft of risk. You know, if we knew exactly what was going to be a huge hit, we'd do it all the time. You'd be very rich people. We wouldn't need investment and subsidy. But the truth is that you are trying to do things new, afresh, keep moving forward, and that requires imagination and it requires confidence, and sometimes I think Wales lacks confidence.
I think we'll be picking up on that point in the Q&A shortly, but I just want to say something what you've said there about risk. In the report, we do very well on enterprise and entrepreneurship, and every good entrepreneur and successful entrepreneur would say they don't do it without risk. Risk is absolutely at the heart of that entrepreneurial success and enterprise. There's always, you've got to take a risk and also accept failure, and, you know, fail quickly. And it's really summing up what you're saying is being bold. So UM. Are you bold in Swansea University? And maybe give us a little flavour of Global Wales as well, because UN chairs Global Wales.
Well,
not everybody will be familiar.
We must be bold and smart, and that's really important. And we must be smart by using the assets that we've got in Wales. And what we sought to do in Wales, of course, is bring together, really in a very unique way, the universities, the education sector, the government, the funding council, the tourist board, to promote Wales and the education that Wales can offer to the world, organised differently. So, for example, Roger, when University College London opened a research facility in one of the cities in China, they had accompanying them the London Symphony Orchestra. Mm. When Welsh universities are actually engaged internationally, we should be taking the Welsh National Opera, we should have the BBC National Orchestra for Wales. So it's actually bringing together the different elements. So for me, it's about, of course, it's about audit. It's also about being competitive. Because actually, when you're out there in the international student market, rankings matter. They are actually making life-changing decisions on the basis of what we have to offer. And if Wales is going to be resilient, it has to ensure that it's involved at the right level, with the right level of investment. And actually, as the panelists have said today, we have to be honest. You used the expression, we must not kid ourselves. And actually, reviewing what our strengths are, what our offering is, building on those strengths, perhaps working in a way which is more collective. So, for example, in Global Wales, we're looking at ways in which working with the Welsh government, we can promote not simply individual universities, but also the Welsh higher education system. So it's a system-to-system approach, working with identified countries in the world, perhaps notably, in the first instance, Vietnam, other areas, huge growth potentials. You know, one of our major challenges is this. We have talent in Wales, but the talent is worldwide. Globalization is the biggest social and economic fact of our time. 66% of the world will live in cities in 2030. 40% of the world will be under 25. How are we setting ourselves up to be able to compete in that environment? Universities have a particular role to play. We have to be organized in a very much smarter way. We are bold. And we need to be bold if we're going to survive.
Well, I think we've got plenty there to be going on with. I'd like to open it up to the floor. Just a reminder, I don't want to tread on the toes of the following panel, which is very much the how. So if we focus on what our assets are, and if you've got any questions, just there'll be a microphone, I think, available in the usual way. So if you just raise your hand, and just if you could identify who you are and who you're representing, that would be really helpful for the rest of the room.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Murphy, and I'm representing lots of people. So I represent What Next, which is a cultural movement. I'm also an artist. I run Oh My Days. I'm also working for Theatre Yolo. Thank you to the panel, because you're brilliant, and you all said brilliant things, and you are speaking to the converted, I think, mainly. I wanted to ask you about creative learning, because I think that's something that hasn't been mentioned very much and is one of our most amazing assets, I think, at the moment. We've had £10 million invested in it in the last 5 years. And this week, and today specifically, it's being showcased at the Tate. And what I'm quite surprised about is that it's not being referenced. It wasn't referenced by our First Minister as something that we should be, because other countries are looking at it. It's brave, it's bold, it's revolutionary. And so I wanted to know what the panel think about how we should be shouting about it, how we should be collectively championing it, and what we should be doing to ensure that there's a further 5 or 10 years investment. Because at the moment, absolutely no one knows what's going to happen beyond 2020 when everything just falls off the edge of a cliff. So I'd like to know what your thoughts about that are about a new curriculum which is going to be rolled out without the support of that creative learning programme.
Thank you for your question. I'd like to put that to Cully, because I'm also interested in, you know, you've come into Wales, and, you know, often we do talk amongst ourselves a lot here, and it is good to have that outside view. From outside, when you came in, and having worked across different cultural sectors in different parts of the UK and wider, just how you found it, and also, you know, just respond.
I guess when I talked about, you know, the sort of rhetoric around placing culture at the heart of everything, I was partly referencing creative learning, because I think that has been a very powerful statement of intent and also delivery model, and I know that because we've run a couple of programs with people referral units where that program has really connected and enabled those young people to really thrive. And so the evidence is all there, and I think what we're not very good at, like with many things, is knowing how to tell that story. But we can only tell that story if we manage to do that collectively. Because me saying that to a few people in London or in Wales or whatever hits certain people, but it isn't the big story. I think there are networks and conversations where we can place that more solidly and say, look what we're doing. And I think that's a serious asset for Wales, because it isn't being done. I mean, it's in England, clearly it's absolutely dissipating and disappearing, and you can see the tangible impact of that is really evident there. So I would advocate and fight for it. I think there might be a better way of doing that more collectively than we've currently got. And clearly the Arts Council will have a view on that as well, and I would hope that those conversations with the Welsh Government will continue to look at not only the hard measures that we've had to report back on, but also what people are saying about it in terms of those teachers and the students and the kind of long-term ambition we want to look at in order to create talent, a talent pipeline, for just not necessarily for the jobs that they'll be doing, but just for good citizenship, you know? Because that's also really important. That is what is our cultural. Sometimes we can get caught up in exams and all that kind of stuff, but what does it mean to be a citizen of the world these days actually requires us to think in all sorts of different ways and deal with all sorts of colliding emotions, and there are ways in which the arts help us do that.
So we need to be more coherent, more joined up.
That's one proposal anyway from my part.
And very interesting what you're saying about the creative learning. Of course, all the studies showing us we're facing, you know, the fourth revolution in terms of AI and automation, those creative skills, the flexibility, the problem solving, are the skills of the future that we, to equip our young talent. So anybody else on the panel want to come back on that question? Just Sophie,
yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think that, the estimations are that, 65% of, children born today will go on to jobs that don't even exist yet. And again, all of the international evidence is that, educating, children in, around knowledge is actually going to be setting them up for failure in the future. And what we do need to be focusing on is, creativity, cooperation, emotional resilience and intelligence. And I think, again, back to the point that I was making about the things that we measure, those are often seen as the kind of soft, fluffy things, but actually they're going to be the things that are critically important if we are to compete, we can't compete with the robots in terms of knowledge, but we can do the things that robots can't do, which is, be human and focus on those things that do make us human. So I think the big challenge for government is to shift a thinking from where culture and the arts and creativity is something for the middle class elites towards it being absolutely critical for our children, young people to be learning in those ways now if they are to prepare for the future. And and it's going to be absolutely critical for our children in our deprived communities. And I've seen some brilliant, I was in Trebannog a couple of weeks ago where there's a brilliant project there with the Arts Council working with the community there, which is building around arts, creativity, skills, connecting neighbourhoods, people in neighbourhoods who'd never spoken before, and all sorts of things coming from that. The single mum who was struggling to get the kids through school, connecting with a neighbour who's now dropping the kids to school, she's then able to have a better chance of accessing work. All of those things, which are really kind of difficult to measure, have come about through that community coming together through creative learning. And so I think we need to be starting to see that as central to the things we do, not as the nice-to-haves.
Roger, do we understand ourselves?
First of all, I pay tribute to our tertiary education in Wales. Our universities are recognised jewels across the world. I've had the great honour of chairing the Cardiff University Business School for 10 years. It is a top 5 business school in the UK. It's a top 100 business school across the world. The majority of our students are coming now from China. And the work that Swansea have done, we might talk about Qatar later on, but Swansea is on Qatar's radar because of the students that come from Doha to Swansea. My great concern in Wales is what's taking place in secondary education. Again, this is not a political point, because this goes across the UK. And the attitude towards the creative arts. Just one thing I'd end with. At the moment, as some of the political observers know, there's, as the First Minister himself mentioned, there is now a race for the new First Minister of Wales, and the bookies are making Mark Drakeford the favourite. All I say is that Mark studied Latin at university. He studied Latin. Now, what do you do with a degree in Latin? Well, you could become the First Minister of Wales. And I think there's a conversation to be had with Mark about his Latin journey. And also the leader of Cardiff City Council, Councillor Hugh Thomas, studied music at university. There's a conversation to be had with Hugh about his journey as well. And the point I'm making here is networking, leveraging, using the Carwin's point about that bit of getting our voice and our understanding heard. And we've got to remind some of our leaders who worked that journey what debt they owe to these particular subjects.
Thank you. Gentleman in the middle in the pale shirt. Yes, I think so. Well, you were quick on, quick off the the microphone's behind you so the room can hear. Thank you.
Thank you. On the subject of politicians, I brought up this point at other IWA meetings. We have expert meetings such as today on all sorts of topics. Nothing is going to change unless it's taken on board by politicians. At the end of the day, they clear the path for new legislation or funding or whatever. Apart from probably politicians from Flanders and Quebec, not a politician, he says. Nearest, perhaps, we have Jane Davison, former politician and former AM. Is Lee Walter still here?
Your question, please.
My question is, what are we going to do about getting what politicians to come to these expert meetings and stay long enough to hear discussions like this? Thank you.
If I can say, I spoke both to Lee Waters, who's here, and Rina Bioris, who had Labour and Plaid Cymru here. Thank goodness they came, and we should support them and thank them for that. Lee, by the way, has gone on to a very important meeting to discuss the M4 relief fraud, which, as you know, is very, very front of mind. So there is a genuine political reason for him to do that. And Rhian, I spoke to, has gone to Denby to attend a very important meeting. The good news is they were both here.
Yes, so, no, that, so, no, I'm yeah. not criticising that.
Okay.
But the general lack of representation of the people that are going to see anything through at this time.
What I'm more concerned about, are there any journalists here today? Oh, good. No, are there any journalists here? No, that is staggering.
I'm here.
No, will you be writing on today?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah. Well, okay, because I didn't think you were. I thought you were in a professional role to facilitate this meeting.
Indeed.
Is anyone from the BBC here? No, there's no one from the BBC. Now, the BBC is... Right. But, dare I say, this is of such great significance that there should be... I don't know if the BBC has an arts correspondent anymore in Wales. Because if you listen to Good Morning Wales, you hear nothing about the arts morning after morning. Rugby, as a chief executive of the Welsh Rugby Union, you had wall-to-wall rugby on BBC. But do we have anything on the arts? Goodness me, no.
Thank you, Roger. I noticed the lady at the front here in the striped top.
Hello, I'm Sarah Morse from the Learned Society of Wales. Part of what seems to be Wales's problem at the minute is that we don't really know our own stories. We don't know the multiple narratives of Wales. As Di Smith said, Wales is a singular noun, plural experience. But it's not being captured anywhere. There's a lot of good work being done in HE. Swansea in particular is a bit of a pioneer with the work of Crewe, Daniel Williams, Wyn Thomas, Kirsty Bahata. But there's no such thing as Wales studies or the study of Wales. There's Irish studies, there's Scottish studies, but Wales doesn't know enough about itself. It's pretty ridiculous. And so there are efforts in this, but it's always precarious. It's always Welsh research about Wales is seen to be not internationally important because it's about Wales, despite the fact it might have an international impact or international influence. It's always seen as parochial. So how can we sort of work to overcome that?
So who are we? How are we distinctive? What's the story we tell ourselves?
Yeah. So one of the questions there respect of creative learning is how can we ensure that tomorrow's teachers, we are reforming our initial teacher training programs, how do we ensure that they are tooled up with the skills necessary to be creative? How can we do that in a way which brings in international influences? How can we use bilingualism as a tool that can reach out, not simply in terms of Welsh English, but perhaps French and Vietnamese and English in Vietnam? How can we provide that international experience? And the point there made in terms of learned society, we so often, and one of the big things coming out of the barometer report is the importance of the Welsh language. And essentially, in the early days, the most pioneering work, for example, on linguistics was in the context of Celtic. And that was done through the medium of Welsh, French, and English. So there are skills here in Wales which are peculiar, which are massively marketable, and which have world significance.
So we undersell them.
Yeah.
Undersell ourselves, and we don't have a clear, distinctive idea of who we are. Cully, what would you say to that as someone who's come to work in Wales? What, you know, when you were outside, did you have a sense of Wales and what you were, your expectations? Have they differed to your experience now living and working here?
Oh gosh, that's such a hard question, isn't it? I mean, I became much more aware of Wales when. Dare I say it, when National Theatre Wales was set up, because there was lots of interest across the arts community and the profile of its work. So I became very aware of that then. I suppose I grew up in the Midlands, so there was an affinity with Wales. There was a lot of, you know, travel across the borders. But in terms of what's been really surprising is the sense that there are nuances and stories that are very particular to Wales. And I don't think I really knew or understood the history of its radicalism, its internationalism, its suffragette legacy, all of that sort of stuff that's really tangible, that is completely surprising to me. And I feel like if the politicians aren't going to fight for creative learning, then let's rise up and be revolutionary about embracing our communities to get them to demand it for them, because that's what Wales has been, hasn't it? You know, and I think there's something about that energy and spirit that sometimes we lose when we don't talk to our communities and are with our communities and empower our communities and are part of our communities. I think we can get caught up in our own little clusters of bureaucrats, artists, all of us are guilty of it. And actually, what is it? What can we do, and what can I individually do about making that shift happen?
We are great storytellers. Forgive me, I've ranted a lot today, if I be a bit more measured here. And our storytelling goes back, as we know, to Giraldus Cambrensis recorded it in the 1300s. Qatar. I went down there 3.5 years ago, and I worked very closely with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. The then ambassador was Nicholas Hopton, who is now the ambassador in Tehran. The current ambassador is A.J. Sharma. And they kept on saying, come down and come down. Before we got to a transactional discussion, where we didn't close the deal for Qatar Airways, which we didn't close it until last April, 3.5 years ago, working with Yusuf Ali Al-Qatar, the Qatari ambassador in London, with the Qataris in Doha, it was going down month by month by month. This was the advice I had, and just get to know people and get to know our friends in Doha. And it was storytelling. The Arabs love stories. So what were the stories I tell them about? I tell them about our rich carbon past, because they have a carbon now and a carbon future for many, many years. And I talked about our carbon past. I talked about downlice, the Industrial Revolution, Keir Hardie, but talked about Snowdon and Snowdonia and the mountains and the water. And then you started getting into our storytelling of the synergies we got, the red kite of Wales, because falcons and falconry is so important in the Gulf. Horses is such part of the Arab DNA and the role of the horse. My great-great-grandfather delivered coal in the Ronza by horse. I could talk about that. As horses working, all of a sudden, this engagement and the rich storytelling to talk about our poets, our musicians, explain to them. But then I talked about our universities. The Qatar 2030 National Plan is about innovation, connectivity, and skills. So I talked about our innovation. I talked about Airbus and Broughton in the north, GE here. I talked about, as I say, our schools of learning. All of a sudden I discovered more Qatari students have gone to universities in Wales than any other university outside of Doha. So, I'll end here, because I went into a meeting with Abdul Basit on the Monday after Brexit, and he is the chief executive of the Qatari International Islamic Bank. Abdul Basit is sitting there resplendent in his thobe, and he just looked at me and smiled and said, "Bes gelit." And I almost fell off my chair. Because he knew the story of the dog in Bes gelit. So we then each told each other a story we knew. He knew it, I knew it, but we recounted the story back to each other. By the end of it, we were almost in tears.
Yeah. Brexit tears. Well, time has time has overtaken us, I'm afraid. It's an incredibly insightful panel. I'm sure you'd like to thank them in the usual way. I'd also like to say thank you to the British Council and also to the IWA. And for those that didn't get their questions in, you've got another opportunity, so get your hand up quickly when the next panel sits. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol, as well, for moderating and sharing that so well.